Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today we are talking about dealing with people you can't stand and how to bring out the best in people at their worst with my guest, Dr. Rick Brinkman. Now, Dr. Brinkman has been in public practice, and that's in quotes, air quotes, since 1980, touring nationally and abroad, performing keynotes and trainings in 18 countries. He is a co-author or author of 6 McGraw-Hill books, including the title that I just mentioned, which has sold over 2 million copies, or is that 200,000 copies? Which is it?
It's much more than 2 million. That was back in 2012. It's closer to 3 now.
Congratulations. This book has been translated into 25 languages, and his latest McGraw-Hill book is Dealing with Meetings. We're going to be talking about this. Dealing with Meetings You Can't Stand, Meet Less and Do More. As we enter the Zoom era, we're going to be talking about an awful lot of things. So quickly, Rick is also the co-author of Dealing with Relatives, Life by Design, Bringing Out the Best in Yourself, and Love Thy Customer. His clients have included the NSA, NASA, Astronauts Corps, Lucasfilm, the Department of Defense, Sony Pictures, the Federal Reserve, Adobe, Wells Fargo, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and many others. He has also been a featured guest on CNN and is a frequent communication expert for publications, such as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Oprah Magazine, and US Today. Rick, good morning. Welcome to Your Partner in Success. And thank you for sending me those two books. I have them on my desk as we speak.
All right. You know what? I've met many people in seminars who told me, you know, I had your book for a long time and I keep it on my desk face out and somehow people treat me differently.
I just had a mental image that I am not going to explain to anybody. So that does make sense because it really, I mean, these books, there's big font on them. One is red, one is blue. And the big, big title on this one is Dealing with People You Can't Stand. I lost it. When these books landed on my desk, I went, Yeah. Because, I mean, we all have to work with people or deal with people or live with people that we really can't stomach at one time or another or chronically, whatever it is. If it's chronic, get a divorce. But here's the thing. We now that we're in what I'm calling the Zoom era, oh, my gosh, it's different, isn't it, when you're trying to deal with, you know, looking at people, talking with people, having to put your pants on to be in these meetings. There's a lot of things going on. But listen, before I get too far into the questions, tell me a bit about yourself that I missed, and excuse my voice, and then let's just get rocking and rolling.
Well, I'm a naturopathic physician, which is a holistic physician by training. I grew up in New York City, but I ended up in Oregon and going to naturopathic medical school there. And when I was a senior, I met a medical doctor who said that the symptom is a metaphor for what's going on. If somebody has uterine bleeding, you should ask him if those were teardrops, what do you think you'd be crying about? He became my mentor, and my practice changed into all counseling and dealing with especially physical symptoms that nothing else worked on. Everybody sent me their hopeless cases, so there's nothing to lose. I might as well pry into their lives, although friends pry, health professionals probe. And I found that when I dealt with different issues, people, relationship issues, or life fulfillment issues, magically physical symptoms would disappear. And that led me and my co-author, Rick, he was also in school with me 1 year behind, to start doing seminars and trainings in communication and life fulfillment. And 4,000 programs, 18 countries later, here we are.
And see, what I'm picking up from what you just said is that, because I've said this all of my life, we are what we think, we are what we drink, we are what we eat. So just as a for instance, if you think, you know, you're looking at your computer monitor as I am right now, and this random thought pops, oh, I've got a headache. Well, yeah, you just gave yourself a headache. You gave yourself permission to just run with that headache. I've noticed that all my life.
Yeah. And, you know, people get comfortable even with their pain rather than make a change. You know, I remember one major, I had a woman had arthritis. She'd had it for 15 years. She tried everything I ever heard of, whether it was traditional or alternative, which is now being called complementary. And so nothing worked. So I pried into her life, and I found her husband works in the federal government. He flies back and forth to Washington, D.C. weekly. She says she's hated that job for 20 years but hasn't expressed it because she wants to support him. When minor upsets would occur, she wouldn't deal with it because they only had, you know, a weekend together each week. She would suppress that. He was supposed to take an early retirement and then decided against it on his own. She suppressed her feelings about that, too. Now, if you suppress too much somebody you care about, it's going to build up a barrier between the two of you. My entire prescription there is to teach her how you can share upset without the other person feeling attacked so they can really hear it. She did this, and 30 days later, her symptoms were gone. So
that
became typical.
I mean, that makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. I had a guy who was depressed and been through 2 years of psychoanalysis. At the end of 2 years, the analysis was, you're depressed. Well, yeah, I knew that, but okay, take this medication. Now he's more depressed because the medication isn't working, and he didn't realize he was violating a personal belief by being on medication. Well, I asked him about his past. He said, filled with failure. I asked about his present. He said, dead-end job going nowhere. I asked about the future. He said, more of the same. Pretty depressing. Here's a quick tip for your listeners. In case you ever get too happy, here's how you bum yourself out. Pick something in your present you hate and see it going forever in your future. You'll feel bad. Well, in his case, you know, I had him clarify his values. We set some goals. We broke down those goals into simple action steps. We did a tune-up on his self-esteem. 2 months later, starts his own business. Depression magically disappears.
We really are what we think. I mean, I
absolutely
noticed that when I was a tiny child because I was a bit pig-headed and didn't really like to have other people tell me what I was thinking or doing. Turns out that has been a good thing for me.
Mm-hmm. You're your own person.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
so communication and relationships is huge, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And this podcast talks a lot about relationships, whether, you know, they're business, personal, which I don't see how you can divide them. You know, I really don't. And, you know, of course, communication, especially, I think, with yourself. If you're lying to yourself, you've got some murky communication going on there, and you're causing yourself and the people around you damage, because whatever it is that you're thinking and doing obviously is going to impact the people around you. I mean, how can it not?
Yeah, of course, it's a dynamic, especially in any committed relationship.
Absolutely. Okay, let's get to these terrific books, because I have been marking and putting sticky notes and you gotta see these things. I've got yellow markers, I've got pink for things that make me go, let me go think about that one. So I'm going to open up just a couple of questions, because we've got, you know, getting to know people you can't stand, we reveal the 10 plus 3 most unwanted and provide you with the laws of understanding. Go ahead and just start where you would like to, because I find this fascinating. I really do.
Well, the 10 behaviors that we found were difficult. And we can all do some of them at different times, depending on context, where we are, what's going on in relationship, who we're with. You know, you can know somebody who seems to be a bully most of the time at work, but you wouldn't believe what a wimp that person would turn into in a different context, or maybe in a different relationship. My wife tells people she has to come to a seminar to hear me speak, because in most social situations, I'll be a nothing person. As I explained to her, I'm a professional. You have to pay me. Any of you with children, you know, your child might come back from the neighbor. Neighbor says, oh, how polite and helpful they are. You know, my child? What? Different context, different relations, different behaviors. So you want to think of behavior, not personality. you know, personality is too big of a generalization to be functionally useful, because that's really how a person is in every situation, in every relationship. But we never know people in all contexts, in all relationships. So thinking about behavior right here and now is much more effective. So we found there's 10 different stress behaviors. And one is called tank. A tank is a direct attack. They're moving forward. It's all about making things happen. You're either part of getting the end result to happen or you get eliminated. Anything that takes too long can escalate the attack. Anything I think is forward motion will de-escalate the attack. A tank is basically a demand for action. What we also have, and we have what we call the lens of understanding. And let me just back up a little bit. You know, we have four basic intents with us. We want to get things done. We want to get those things done right. We want to get along with people, and we want to get appreciated by people. All right, so coming back to get things done, if things are not getting done, then we go into what's called the caution zone, where we get more controlling. All right, look, why don't you do this? You do this. I'm going to take care of that. You're on the phone. Now, being controlling isn't necessarily a problem. In fact, sometimes it's a solution because you make things happen. But if people get too stressed out, then that can easily become a tank attack where they run right over you. Out of that same zone of get it done and control, we also have sniper. Now, this is when people have some suppressed anger or resentment. So you might stand up at a meeting and they say, I got a great idea. Let's play horse. I'll be the head. You just be yourself. Ooh, don't get all emotional. Can't you take a joke? It's to the face. It could be behind the back. And this is malicious type sniping. Very often there's some kind of suppressed anger or resentment. Now, it could be specifically with you, maybe like you got the promotion they think they should have gotten, or it could be generalized with everybody, in which case that means this person is just suppressing general anger and resentment, and they're an equal opportunity sniper. It's not a personal issue with you. What you also get out of that controlling area of the lens is know-it-all behavior. That's right. I know 99% of everything, and I'll happy to tell you how much I know for hours on end. And they really do know what they're talking about, but the problem with this behavior is the unwillingness to hear what others have to say. So it's really gone too far. And this is, you know, in terms of meetings, this is a big issue where they dominate meetings and take you down tangents that may not be relevant. Going to another area of the lens, let's say get it right. Now, from get it right, the next step in the caution zone is perfection. So if I look at what is and I look at what could be, and what is doesn't measure up to what could be, and then I feel helpless to do anything about it, that's how whining starts. And when people whine, they basically have their radar tuned to everything is wrong, nothing's right, and it's always that way. And that's all they see around them. A cousin of whining that occurs in a similar way out of that get-it-right perfection is negativity, what we call no people. Forget it. We tried it. Nothing ever changes. Every silver cloud has a dark lining. You suggest an idea to them, they say, pull! Boom! Got that idea. Launch another while I reload. The difference between whining and negativity is whining is feeling helpless, whereas negativity is hopeless. But negativity and whining are both virulent. They're unique among our 10 behaviors because they can spread like the flu through a team of people, and before you know it, everybody's doing it. Incidentally, a third behavior that also spreads is the sniping behavior. I'm sure most of your listeners, especially in your work life, can have experienced how one department can develop an ongoing sniping relationship with another department. They do a Hatfield-McCoy thing. The other behaviors don't do that. They create problems, but they don't necessarily replicate themselves. What you also get out of that get-it-right perfection is fine. Do it your way. Don't come crying to me when it doesn't work out. And from that point on, I say nothing. I just withdraw and I'm quiet. Now, you get nothing from a completely different area of the lens, and that's also – that comes out of the get-along area of the lens, where you want to be nice, want everybody to go along. It's much more people-oriented. So far, all the behaviors we talked about tank, sniper, know-it-all, whining, negativity, and fine, do it your way, nothing, are all oriented. It's about tasks. When we move into the people area of the lens, well, you know, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all. I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings, so I say, confrontation is not pretty, so I say, nothing. So it's the same behavior because you're not hearing anything, but there's a different motivation there. What you're also going to get in that same area of the lens from get along, and the caution part of get along is approval. You want people's approval. And so you're going to be agreeable. That's what we call yes people. Should we go here? Okay. You want to have dinner? Okay. You want to not have dinner? Okay. And they're just really agreeable, but you really don't know where they stand. And definitely if they're upset about something, it's going to get suppressed because if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all. But then what can happen is if the upset is significant, it'll fester and they can go from nice, friendly, yes person to your face to sniper behind the back, what we call passive aggressive. What you also get out of that area of the lens is maybe behavior. And this is usually specifically in a situation where you have to make a decision, but it could possibly hurt somebody's feelings. So if you don't want to do that, you're going to say, I'll think about it. Ask me later. Maybe. And that's my final decision. I'm sure all of your listeners at one time told a salesperson, I'll think about it. You weren't going to think about it. That's
nope.
Approval-oriented behavior.
Exactly.
Okay, shifting mental gears, going to the other air lens, which comes out of appreciation, to be appreciated by people. And the caution area, if they're not getting appreciated, is get attention, trying to get people to notice. And so in that area of the lens, you can get grenade behavior. Nobody cares. That's the problem world today. It's the government's fault. It's between tank and grenade. The tank should be in jail. Grenade should be institutionalized. No, I'm kidding. The tank means to do it. The tank takes aim but leaves other useful people and office equipment standing. That's okay. The grenade blows up in 360 degrees, and you hear all the stuff that has nothing to do with the present circumstances. That's because a tank attack is a demand for action, whereas a grenade tantrum, it's the tantrum, is a demand for attention. What you also get out of that attention area of the lens is another kind of sniper. This is friendly fire. This is people who like you, so they say, I never forget a face, but in your case, I'll make an exception. It's friendly teasing. It's friendly put-down humor. It's not really intending to hurt anybody, though sometimes it can have some inadvertent, unwanted side effects. And then last but not least, what you get in that area of the lens is think they know it all. That's right. I'm an expert. I believe it, too, because when words come out my mouth, they come back in both my ears, and I think this must be true. I just heard it twice. So those were the basic 10 behaviors that we found. And then all of us can do some of them at some point in some context of relationship, but we're going to have certain ones that we're going to be more comfortable with. And it could be totally different. I mean, you know, I remember in preparing for a seminar, I was interviewing the CEO of this company, and she was telling me, oh, yeah, she's definitely in that get-it-done area of the lens when she's at work and definitely sometimes very controlling. And if she gets too stressed out, she admits she can become a tank. But then she says when she comes home, she becomes a whiner to her husband about the problems at work. Her husband cannot understand. How does she possibly run a company? She's such a whiner. But he doesn't get to see her in her blazing tank glory. Again, even the people we're closest to, we only know a small sliver of what they're capable of. You always have to assume something else. So those were the basic 10 that we found. And then a follow-up to the book People We Can't Stand was dealing with relatives specifically, that type of relationship. And in there we found a bunch of corollaries that relate to tank, like as the general, the person just in charge of the family, and you got the VIP, the person who's like, if you were sick, they were sicker. If you had a great vacation, they had a great vacation. But there were three that didn't correlate directly to any of our 10, and that was the martyr and the meddler and the judge. So the martyr
really
is kind of relates to that get along.
I would think
lens,
they would,
you know,
be the top
that.
Three. Honestly, I mean, well, I'm scanning my family, what's left of them, and I'm identifying a lot of these people. And sadly, I've identified myself more than once. I'm probably going to have to make apologies.
Well, the top three, and you made the, said the magic word, in family. It's more likely in a family personal relationship where you get the martyr and the meddler. So, you know, the martyr's doing everything for everybody, and then finally they have a little martyr meltdown. Nobody cares about me. The judge, now that the judge you can get also more in a business setting too. There, that's the nitpicking. It comes out of that get it right perfection. Whereas with whining and negativity, it goes into generalizations. Everything's wrong, nothing's right. The judge goes in the opposite direction, down into details that don't really matter. And that's what we call nitpicking. And then how you get a meddler is if you make the judge with somebody who's like a tank, or in the relative book we call the general, that's how you get the meddler, because they see what you're doing and they judge you and it's not good enough. And then that overly assertive part of them just takes over and decides to do it for you. And that's meddling. So that, and we called it the plus three because there was, this is now the third edition of that book. The first two editions, we just dealt with the basic 10 and we added the plus three on the third edition.
Well, Rick, I have to ask, we're talking. Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but my hand went up. I have a question. So when we're talking about family, you can't see me, but my hand's waving in the air. When we're talking about family in particular, a lot of these personalities, I guess, or these behaviors, rather, that you described, I mean, I recognize all of them in myself and around the people around me. How can we not? But my question is, when you're saying family, does this also include spouses or significant others? Because guess what? I recognize that too.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. That would be in the family category, spouse or significant others. Absolutely. Siblings.
Okay. That makes sense. I wasn't sure if we were kind of separating those out. So I have to tell you, I'm a bit uncomfortable. I'm looking at myself going, you, I'm pointing at myself going, geez, you are a witch. Oh, bad, Denise. Okay, I'm not that one. This is making me a bit uncomfortable, which is why we're talking, because if we don't understand the things that we do, that, you know, the way we present in different scenarios and, you know, different areas of our lives, we can't possibly change it, or at least identify it and say, "Nah, I'm good with it." I mean, I'm uncomfortable. So you're doing a good job.
We all have it. It's something. Some of them we're going to do more often than others. So there's an innocence to this, and it's, you have to understand where people are coming from and what they really need from you. I mean, let's say we're in a work environment and somebody's being a tank, then you go, okay, we're not moving fast enough. All right, we're going to make this happen, sir. What do you think we need to do first? All right, who's going to be in charge of this? You just kind of move forward fast, and that quickly de-escalates the tank attack. You know, if somebody's chronically sniping at you, then you really have to clear the air, you know, as to what's going on. Now,
divorce,
you know, we had that other
there.
Kind of snipe. Yeah.
Seriously.
That can be a solution. In fact, there are four choices you always have with people. You can do nothing and suffer, or you can do what you just said, vote with your feet. You know, leaving is a very valid choice. In fact, in doing research for the book Dealing with Relatives, we found the number one coping strategy is geography.
Yes.
Or your third choice.
I love my family. I do. But they live in California. I live in Louisiana. I'm the only one here. I've always been the only one here. And as much as I adore them, I will tell them to their faces, there is a reason I live in a galaxy far, far away. Fortunately, they get it.
Exactly. And you know, sometimes with that level of distance, then you have more of appreciation when you do get together, so you don't get into a lot of BS with
each other.
Yeah. So four choices: do nothing and suffer, leave. You could change your attitude. You make a mental adjustment, and then somehow magically you stop suffering around this person, and/or you change your behavior, because we're always in a behavioral balance with people, and if we shift that balance, that forces them to shift. You know, like going back to the tank attack. Let's say the boss is going tank. if I start going into details, well, you know, here's what, and this, and how it happened, that's not moving forward. That's going to sound to them like just making excuses. And it's like saying, you want a little more gasoline for your fire? But if I realize what they need at that moment is forward motion, and everything's talking about the future, not how this happened, but what we're going to do about it, that very quickly will de-escalate the tank attack. You know, with somebody who's whining, you're going to have to, first of all, unfortunately, you have to listen to them. But then you'll interrupt them. And a little cue as to how long you should listen to them is wait till they repeat themselves. Once they say something they already told you, then you excuse you interrupting. Let me make sure I understand. So that's called a statement of intent. When you say the purpose behind what you're about to do, because people want to be understood, so they stop and you go, so you're saying blah, 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 blah. And you give a complete backtrack summary of what they said. And then you roll up your sleeves and you start asking questions and digging in. Because the problem is people whine in big generalizations, but you can't problem solve a generalization. You have to get them to be specific. So when you understand why people are acting the way they do and you know what they need, then the strategy becomes very apparent. And I urge people to think of communication like a phone number. You need all the digits and you need them in the right order. I mean, if you have a 10-digit number and you happen to dial the area code at the end as an afterthought, the call does not get through properly. If you've got all the digits correct in the correct order, but you happen to turn a 6 into a 9, hey, that's only 10% error. Call does not get through. Communication is equally specific.
And, you know, that's a brilliant analogy. I never thought of it like that. I tend to be logical, linear, and analytical. And I always get a little bit bugged by people who want to tell me stuff. It's just like, what does this have to do with what we're talking about? Yeah, I'm glad that your nephew is okay, and I really am, but can we move on? Can we get this stuff done? And look, I moved from California, which is exactly what I was. I was a California. I was born and raised there. And that's how I thought, you know, let's move. Let's get it done. Come on, get out of my way. Then I moved to the deep south where I had to say, you know, when people ask me in the parking lot of something, hey, how's your mom and them? Oh, crap, here we go. First of all, I'm not from here. You don't know my mom. What do you want? And boy, I'll tell you what, that was a huge, huge thing. And down here, they want to know, who's your mom? What school did you go to? Are you Catholic? Seriously, those are the things that I get asked in the deep south, or I used to. Now they don't even ask anymore. But it was a big problem for me because I just, you know, here we are, here's point A, here's point B, here's point C. What the hell are you talking about? And I probably offended a ton of people before I got it, that I was in a different zone, if you will, and that communication is about actually speaking with other people and not at them and not just answering a question and then getting in my car and walking off. It took a long time, longer than I am comfortable with admitting. But once I got it, I was like, oh. So even though I'm still very logical, linear, and analytical, I'm a lot more friendly, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Oh, totally, totally. I grew up in New York City. And in New York City, put down humor is at its zenith. All right, everybody teases everywhere, but it's nothing like it is in New York City. You want to tell your friend you like him? You say, I'm going to break your legs off, beat your head up to the bloody pulp, and throw away the limbs. And he was always my best buddy. And when I went west, I finally, and it was really with my co-author, that one time he admitted that he was laughing on the outside and bleeding on the inside. That for him, grew up in Cincinnati, it wasn't at that level. He didn't appreciate the warm and fuzziness of that high energy put down humor.
Yeah, and see, so I have a degree in sarcasm, and sardonic is, you know, a sub degree, so I get it. Which, by the way, does not work well in email communications, and we're going to talk about that. You cannot be sarcastic, sardonic, or bitchy in email. So we'll move on to that in a bit.
Okay.
Okay, so where were we? I interrupted. I'm so sorry.
Well, no, you didn't at all. So we were talking about the 10 behaviors, and then we had the plus three, which was that we found initially in relatives, and we added them to the book. And communication like a phone number. So here I want to tell you a story about where I had a revelation, and this is about, like, the phone number. I'm in my office with a couple. It's the end of the visit. Everybody's feeling really good. She suddenly turns to him and says, "Honey, let's go to the Rose Gardens." And he goes, "Nah." And she goes, "Okay." And I go, "Wait a second. What's your intent right now? Why did you bring this up?" She says, "Well, we're feeling close. We've been having a long time. We have an hour before I pick up the kids. I thought it'd be nice to spend some quiet time together." And he goes, "That's a great idea. I don't want to be outside. Too hot, too buggy. How about the cafe we've been meaning to try?" She goes, "Sure." Now, I ask your studio audience, does she care about going to the Rose Gardens? No. She cares about spending time together. That's the intent. Intent is like the area code of the phone number. It puts you in the right general vicinity. And anytime you begin a communication with a statement of intent, you're going to set up a clear communication. You know, I also saw a lot with couples where intent is positive, but it doesn't get expressed and a misunderstanding occurs. So let's say somebody's upset about something, all right, and now they want to clear the air. That's a good intent. So they go to their partner, and they don't speak their intent. They just go, "You know, I was upset the other day," and he said, "da-da-da-da, because," and then their partner hears a sound in their mind like this. We are under attack. This is not a drill. Oops. If you say, "I love you, I care about you, I hate to have something blocking our communication, I would like to clear the air," now they know where you're coming from. Home is not where you go when you're tired of being nice to people. So that's the area code of the phone number. But wait, there's more. So let's go back to that couple in the Rose Gardens. All right, she wants to spend time together, but why did she choose Rose Gardens? Why didn't she say dinner for two or a movie or a cruise? The answer to that is criteria. So let's look at the criteria here. They only have an hour, so there's a time criterion it has to fit into. Maybe geography goes along with that since Rose Gardens is on the way home. Maybe there's budgetary criteria, it won't cost anything. Maybe there's atmospheric criteria, it's a romantic, quiet place. Maybe it's a place of special meaning to them, or maybe the opposite, it's of no meaning to them, so they can be fresh and new with each other. Well, whenever people have an idea, an opinion, or a point of view, it starts out with intent. They then run their intent through the relevant criteria, and out pops the idea. But in this case, there's no intent and criteria, so he just thinks, nah. Once he gets time together, he wants to avoid the bugs and heat, so he suggests the cafe. Now, if he doesn't know her criteria, and let's say she wants a romantic, quiet place, and the cafe is a noisy dive, then he's not going to understand why she rejects the cafe and says Rose Gardens. And if he doesn't know her criteria, he won't understand why she rejects she doesn't know why he rejects Rose Gardens as cafe. And so this is like the phone number, and it goes intent, criteria, idea, or intent, criteria, point of view, or intent, criteria, opinion. And if you train yourself to speak in that order, intent, criteria, and then whatever you have to say, you are going to avoid so much conflict in your life. You know, I found there's five areas I've noticed that that create conflict, and if you really pay attention to them, you'll wipe out at least half the conflict in your life. Intent, be clear about your intent. Anytime you're worried about somebody taking something the wrong way, it's definitely a signal for starting out with intent. And then whenever ideas or point of views are being discussed, you need intent, but you also have to specify your criteria. What are the factors you're trying to achieve?
Now, I deal mostly with email, and I'm assuming that these issues also are very appropriate for email.
Oh, yeah. So we have to go back in time. And there was once a late 60s, a professor named Albert Moravian does an experiment. He made a film with some people communicating, soundtrack off the film, runs it through a synthesizer, makes the words incomprehensible, but tone, volume, and speed are intact. He then has a transcript prepared as actually says what people actually said. He gathers a group of people. He shows them the film. There's no sound, no images, just. Then he plays the soundtrack. No words or images. Then he hands out the transcript. Most people read it and they think these are three different interactions. that's a business meeting. Those people are angry. These are obviously good friends. They're shocked to learn, no, it's all from the same interaction. He says, what do you believe is really going on then? And from their responses, he concludes 55% of the meaning we make in a communication is based on how that looks to us. 38% is based on how it sounds to us, which is tone, volume, and speed. And 7% is based on the actual words that are spoken. Now, the 55, 38, and 7 doesn't mean any part is important. And, you know, we have expressions that relate to this. Seeing is believing. Action speaks louder than words. But coming back to email now, tone of voice is taken more personally than any other part of our communication. Tone reflects emotional state. Wherever a person is emotionally will come out through their tone. Conscious mind is picking the concepts we want to communicate, which then get encoded in the symbol system we call words and language. So a very common trap that people fall into is you could be feeling something that really has nothing to do with the person you're now interacting with. So, of course, with good intent, you suppress what's going on. Then you speak, but your emotional state is going to leak out through your tone. I mean, I'm sure all your listeners have experienced, let's say, somebody's customer serving them. Customer service person says, have a nice day. Now, do you think they really care? No.
Nope.
The way it sounds does not match. When there is a mismatch, a mixed message, we are going to believe the higher number. So coming to email, here's the problem. Email is just a bunch of 7%. It's just words on a page or on a screen. And we hallucinate freely as to how we think the other person sounds when they say it. And our hallucinations are based on our blood sugar curve, our stress level, and everything we've got going on that day. So, you know, you said sarcasm and sardonic. Those concepts are communicated via tone. It's not so much what you say, but it's how you say those certain things that really become the sarcasm. So,
true. In the deep south, yeah. We will say, bless your heart. Doesn't mean what you think it means. And if we say, bless your little heart, that means we are telling you to your face that you are too stupid to wash it off. You're doomed.
Yes. And in New York City, there wouldn't be any euphemisms. But that's a problem in the email. So we are writing it, and we're hearing our own tone as to how we mean it, but that's not necessarily how people take it. So the first thing you got to do is anytime you get an email, you have to realize I am hallucinating freely, and I don't really know how people sound, and it may not be how I'm hearing it. And then that leads me to, is email really the best way to proceed? And I would say anytime you're worried about people taking things the wrong way or you're not sure or you're taking this in a certain way, there's any kind of emotional content that you're hallucinating about, you should bail on email. Don't let it continue in that format because in emotional situations, it's going to be our tone that communicates to each other that we care or whatever. You know, I had a client once I did a free thing for them when I'm in Seattle. They didn't want me to do a thing for the management. Sure, I'll do that for an hour. And then, I was going up there again. I said, hey, do you want to do that? And when I went up there, they would pay just for one night hotel because I had to stay over to be able to be at their facility at 7 a.m. So I did that again. And then I got an email that they didn't think they were going to be charged for the hotel. And I'm just totally confused because, well, this is the third time we did it. And that's what we've always done. So I don't know. And they go, well, we'll do it this time, but da-da-da. So I, immediately pick up the phone. Oh, Mary, I'm so sorry. It's not a big deal, but this, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. And all the healing, all the communication, all the good feeling was communicated in tone between the two of us. If this had been left in email, we both would have walked away with bad feeling. And a year later, still have bad feeling whenever we thought about it.
Right.
But
right.
Because we got on the phone with each other, we not only had good feeling, we got even better good feeling.
I'll do that. If I pick up an email that has gone a little bit too far both ways, I'll just stop. And I walk away because I need to calm down. And I know that I'm already a little bit miffed. I'm a little bit hostile, perhaps, or just ticked off. It doesn't, whatever's going on. And once I calm down a bit, it could be that day, it could be the next day, but I'll pick up the phone and say, hey, let's chat about what's going on. Where did we miss the boat? And it always, always ends well, 100% of the time.
If you're ever worried about people taking things the wrong way, that's your signal. Bail on email. That's a very clear signal.
And you're using that term. You've used it quite a bit. I took a note. Don't take this the wrong way. I'm going to tell you right now, you say that to me, we're going to rumble. Because you have already signaled what you're about to say or do, and I'm prepared to probably bloody your nose. Not a good way to start any kind of conversation, just so you know.
No. Yeah, I took that internal. If you worry about someone taking the wrong way, but saying that is not a good idea.
Yeah, it's a really bad idea. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So if you're worried about people taking things the wrong way, if you need to be, if it's more complex, if you have to gather information and it's any more complex than one yes or no answer, you really need to be in an interactive format, meaning on the phone or face-to-face, because realize email or any written communication is a solitary event. I might be reading your email and I think I totally understand what you're wanting from me, but there's no check and balance there. You know, I might think we're on the same page and we're not even in the same book with each other. So anytime you have to gather information, it's more complex than yes or no, you really should be in an interactive format. Anytime you're worried about emotional or you think there's emotions, you definitely want to be in an interactive format.
Exactly. And we're talking a lot about tone here. And you mentioned, you know, the customer service person saying, oh, you have a nice day. You know good and well that they really didn't like having to deal with you for whatever reason. It's their fault, obviously. And you know, you walk away going, right now I'm having a bit of a kerfluffle with Hunter fans. I cannot get them to communicate with me at all. I'm having some bad feelings about Hunter fans, which is a shame because I've always loved their products. Today, not so much. So communication is really, really important. But I have found, this is just kind of an offside, I have a soft voice and I know that. I have found throughout the course of my life that I can say the most unpalatable things with a very soft voice, be 5 miles away before somebody says, hey, what did you just say to me? So, you know, that's a quick little snippet there.
That's the 38% of your soft voice.
Yes. Yeah, it's got. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about Zoom and meetings because I know we're covering a lot of territory here. But the thing is, right now, everybody is on Zoom for one reason or another. There's now a thing called Zoom exhaustion, I think it's being called. You know, people are just saying, oh, my gosh, not another one. Yeah, and, you know, of course, there are reports where people are not dressing from the bottom up. They're getting dressed. I think there was one Mexican senator who stripped naked while she was on a government Zoom call. She just wasn't paying attention. What are some of the best advice that you can give to people who are on these Zoom calls? They're trying to get their communications heard and listened to with the different people who are on these things. I think this is a whole new way of communicating. It's not new, but it's becoming a lot more prevalent. What are you seeing?
Well, in any meeting context, first of all, there's a few things you want to put in place. And what typically happens in a meeting is some people are going to talk too much. You're more assertive people. And other people are not going to talk at all. You're more passive people in the lens. And the analogy here is you have two eyes, your right eye and your left eye, see from two different points of view. They're slightly different. And when your brain synthesizes those two points of view, you see three dimensions. So really what we want in any meeting situation is to hear from everybody, to get everybody's point of view on whatever we're discussing, because that creates what I would call holographic thinking, where you're really looking at something from all the different angles and you're putting it together. And so you're going to come up with higher quality solutions and ideas. So the first thing that we have to do is there's got to always be a speaking order in a meeting, because what naturally happens, your passive people drop out, and then your assertive people really are not listening to each other. They're waiting for breathing changes. And when somebody inhales, then they jump into that space. And this is even more of an issue in those virtual type meetings. So I would suggest you always have a speaking order. And on those Zoom meeting that I was not running, so if I was running a meeting, I'd put all the pieces in place ahead of time. But I suggested to the person running it, because he opened it up for a discussion, put out a question there. And I said, Kelsey, before we go any further, may I suggest that, all right, let's use the chat. Everybody open up the chat. If you want to speak, just type your name into the chat. That would be like the equivalent of raising your hands. But even better than that, once you see people's names, now you've got a very clean speaking order, and everybody has a chance to speak. And because you know your turn is coming, then you can actually relax and listen to each other. So a speaking order can be voluntary, which in this case, you know, we were all together in a room, might raise a finger, and then you'd want to have a whiteboard there, and you put the person's name on the whiteboard so you see where you are in the queue and you know your turn is coming. In a virtual meeting, I'd say use the chat for that purpose. An alternative is just to go in a circular order around the room, whether it's a physical room or a virtual room. Just go around and call on everybody. And this ensures that you're going to hear from everybody. Your assertive people won't talk too much, and your passive people will actually contribute. If you have some people go on and on, you know, like you have know-it-alls, then you should always have a time limit for speaking for any one moment on the queue. But usually once you put a speaking order in place, it becomes very orderly. Then the next thing we have to have there is a focus point. What are we actually talking about? You don't want to be going down any tangents. And so I find a simple way to do this is, let's say we put up a PowerPoint slide, all right? And this could be in a physical meeting, we're projecting a PowerPoint slide, it's blank, or in a virtual meeting, of course, we could share the screen and see this. And in the title area, you put, what are we talking about now, and how are we talking about it? So what are we talking about, let's say, a new policy? And how are we talking about it? We're talking about the positives. What do we like about it? The pros, all right? And then when we're done with that, we'll switch that. Now, what are the cons or considerations about that? We all have to know what we're talking about and how we're talking about it. Now, what can make that dial that in even more is on the agenda, every agenda item has a statement of purpose. What do you really want from the group? Because that keeps the conversation focused. So let's say we have an agenda item, and this agenda item is the office move. What's the purpose of this in two sentences or less? Well, to minimize the impact on your team's productivity by the office move. Okay, that's important. Focus, statement of focus. What do you want from me? We want you to come knowing your team's workflow and having considered other days of the week or times of day that will be less disruptive for you. So now you know what to be focused on and how to be talking about it. That really helps to have that on the agenda. You know, I call this air traffic control. I find that to think of meetings like a jet plane flight, it's a bunch of people in a contained space. They don't really want to be there. The meeting could start late, you know, and then you miss your connections on the other end. It could be hijacked, you stray off course. So air traffic control is a speaking order and a focal point. Next thing we want to do is flight recording. So on that same PowerPoint slide, you know, when people say what they say, we will bullet what they say. We summarize it in a bullet point. And then Mary says what she has to say, and we summarize in a bullet point. And now when you start seeing all these points of view visually, and we're seeing them all on one slide, that's what creates the hologram. Because if we leave things on an auditory level, the moment you say it, it's there, and then it's gone in the ethers. And what tends to happen is people repeat themselves, you know, and because if it's only there when you say it, then and you think it's important, you're going to say it a bunch of times. But if we put it on the PowerPoint slide, we see it, we see everybody else sees it. 5 minutes later, it's still there. So it prevents one person from repeating themselves as well as other people of having to restate it. They might just say, I agree what Rick said about having a cue. And I think what's also important, so they might just say one thing, but then you add more to it. So that's what I call flight recording. And I find that really creates the hologram. When you put together everybody has a chance to speak, and you're flight recording it visually on a PowerPoint slide, you really see the big picture. And I found whenever I put those things in place in a meeting, everybody's like, oh my God, that was such a great meeting. I can't believe it. We got more done in less time.
And I'm willing to bet that a lot of people, I tend to repeat myself. It annoys me. It's got to annoy other people. So I'm now aware of it, I hope. But I'm wondering if some of this, you know, setting up this process and repeating it with, you know, subsequent meetings, let's say that you're a remote team and that you've got this process and the people know what is expected of them. I'm wondering if there's a little bit of brain changing, brain training going on that nobody expected, but it's happening.
What do you mean by brain changing, brain training?
Well, you know, you said there's always that one person, me, who will repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. And once, let's just assume I'm in that meeting and I see, well, Denise said blah, 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 blah. I now instantly realize I don't have to go beat people over the head with it. That's brain training,
right?
Isn't it? Okay, that's,
yeah, it's there.
My intent was there. I didn't state it. So sorry.
Okay.
But yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Find that whenever I put this process in place, people grab it like a life preserver and never let go, because suddenly the meetings become much more efficient and you get so much more done at a higher quality in a shorter amount of time. And you certainly avoid all the red zone behaviors, you know, tank sniper, know-it-all, all those things. You know, like know-it-alls could go on and on and on, except that we have a time frame to speak. So, your time is up. They can't take you down a tangent because this is not what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about. I found it controls all the behaviors, not only control, but it prevents all the behaviors. And it's very easy to implement this because everybody hates meetings universally. Even the person who, you know, if they didn't show up, you could have a really good meeting. Even they will tell you how bad meetings are. And so if you suggest to somebody who runs the meeting, hey, how'd you like to hear an idea that makes our meetings shorter, more focused and productive? It's a rare human being that says, wow, we don't want that. What will we do for wasted time and misery?
Exactly. Yeah, I used to do a lot of, you know, community projects. I chaired a lot of committees. I don't do that anymore because I got worn out. And exactly what you're talking about, you know, the same couple, two people, me and one other, it seemed like, did all of the work. The other know-it-alls did a lot of chatting but no real function. And I finally just said, I can't keep doing this. I will probably blow up a meeting room and go to jail. So I quit. I really wish that I had known that you could do this or this was a good idea back then. I might still be doing community projects. Am I going to go back to it? No, but still, it would have solved a lot of problems. So if you're, you know, committee chair, pay attention, write this down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, meetings can be fun when you have that kind of structure. Because you start.
I've never
it,
been
you know,
in a meeting
people,
I liked ever, not
yeah,
once.
Well, you've never been in my meetings, then.
There you
we'll
go.
Have to have a meeting once.
There you go. I think we're doing that right now.
Yeah,
so,
that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're teaching me things that I honestly didn't know. I mean, this is a terrific idea, especially for people who are Zooming right now. And it may be, this is a question for you, Rick. They may have already kind of gotten into that free-for-all kind of format of meetings, and everybody's frustrated. Not much is getting done. They have to keep going back over the same stuff over and over again. But it's not too late, is it? Somebody can take
Never
control or come up with an idea and say, hey, I heard this terrific idea on your Partner in Success Radio. I want you to buy these books, and now let's really get to communicating. So it's never too late. Mm-hmm. You don't have to stick with what started that doesn't work. You can move on.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember when I first saw the power of a cue, I was on a board as a vice president. And the president, when people raised their hand, he had a pad. He'd write, all right, Mary, and then John, and now we have Frank, go ahead. And then the next, all right, now we have John, and then we're going to have Mary, and da, da, da. And he would read from the pad this cue. And I thought, what I observed and I felt is this relaxation came over the room. Everybody was suddenly relaxed and listening to each other. And I realized, wow, this would be even better if we just stick it on a whiteboard so people could see the order and they know their turn is coming. Because human beings can only pay attention to 7 ± 2 things at any one time. And so if I'm listening for breathing changes, I'm not totally focused on what people are saying. But if I know my turn is coming in 2 people, then I'm just relaxed and my attention is 100% there and listening to what people are saying. And then if whatever I say is bulleted on the PowerPoint slide, it's like putting pieces of a puzzle together. And suddenly it also depersonalizes it. That's not your piece, but you put that piece into the puzzle. Somebody puts another piece into the puzzle, and we come up with, it's just thrilling, actually, how group process can be so effective.
Oh, I can see it. And you know who this would be absolutely game-changing for is educators and students who are now doing a lot of their homework via Zoom and, you know, different platforms. I mean, I think educators could really get together with their students and, you know, no one student is, you know, being the bully in the corner. The other student is not hiding under the desk because they've got gum in their hair and can't get back up. There's just so many things going on with children, small children, big children, teachers who have never had to teach like this. I think this would be brilliant for them.
Mm-hmm. It'd be nice for Congress, too. We got 2 minutes to speak, make a point that's relevant. They'll give a speech here, all right? Let's
talk
about the issues, your considerations.
I don't see it happening. Do you? I mean, come on. These people love to hear the sound of their own voice. We don't, but they do.
Well, the process is broken a little bit. It's not the way it needs it to be. I mean, James Madison created the Constitution. He said friends could disagree, but they could still be friends with each other.
Absolutely.
It was about, yeah.
But, yeah, I love the idea of, you know, getting to the point. That's, you know, the California girl and me, but, you know, get to the point and make sure everybody is involved, not just a few people, not one person or two people ad nauseum. Everybody's involved. Mm-hmm. They're really excited. Now they're getting creative. And I have noticed, I'm sure you have as well, that when people sit up straight, they take a breath and they're listening. And then, you know, they're jotting down notes, they're watching your whiteboard and those bullet points. All of a sudden, because they are engaged, their creativity just automatically kicks in. They're not tired and thinking, mm-hmm. oh, man, when is this going to be over? I hate her mm-hmm. hair, whatever it is that we're thinking. You know, would that guy stop slurping his coffee? I'm going to have to kill him, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I mean, you know, all of a sudden, the creativity part of you goes, ooh, and your hand goes up and you've got something really important to share.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. Okay, so speaking of wanting to kill the guy with the coffee, which, you know, I can't ever remember what that thing is, but when I hear people chewing or smacking their gum, I just go, ah, and I have to leave the room. I can't do it. Miso something. But anyway, so can I change that reaction to people or do I just leave? I mean, how do you change your reactions to people? And I know that is a broad question. We've only got a couple minutes, but can you tackle that or do we, you know, come back another time?
Yes. Well, we could come back for a little deeper, but let's talk about that briefly. And it's a very important question as well as a good question because even being successful changing your behavior begins with an internal change in your own reactions to yourself. And what you have to realize is, you know, we create associations. You know, you hear a song and it takes you back to your time. You smell something and suddenly you're transported back. You didn't do that on purpose. Your mind just does that for you. And associations are created through repetition, like the song that plays over and over again, or intensity. If you get sick in a certain food, it's a while before you want to eat that food. So how we get stuck in patterns is we tend to replay the past the way it was. Remember that meeting, that person said that I felt bad. Well, what you're doing at that point is you're doing reps to the way it was. Next time you see that person, you're going to feel bad even more quickly because you've been practicing in your spare time. So you have to break that cycle, and you can't not replay the past or preplay the future. That's what your mind is doing. Oh yeah, hot stove. I'll remember that. But what you can do is make sure you replay the past the way you would have liked, what would you have liked to say? How would you like to have felt? And then imagine that happening in the future. So when I was learning to speak in front of groups, I was scared. Like anybody, I wanted to be calm and centered. So I asked myself, who would be calm and centered in front of 300 people? And I thought of Kwai Chang Kang from the Kung Fu television show. You know, that was David Carradine, late 70s, Kung Fu master in the old Wild West. And I would imagine being him. What does he feel inside? How does he think? How does he view the world? And then after I got in touch with all that, then I would imagine that last time I was in front of a group, but being as Kwai Chang, how would it have been if I felt that way? And I would replay that, and then imagine the next time I'm going to be in front of a preplay. And I wiped out all nervousness in a 2-week period. And I've done this for many people in many things, but also when speaking in front of groups, it's amazing how quickly you can go from scared to death to totally okay. And what that is you have a model. Who's got the quality you want? Now, in my case, it was a fictional character. It could be somebody real who you know. Or I had a patient who wanted to jump up first thing in the morning and exercise. I say, who do you think would do that? I'm expecting to hear Rocky or Schwarzenegger.
Tony Robbins.
He goes, yeah, my dog. Woo! Out first thing in the morning. And he imagined being the dog and he waking up and boom, he was out there. So it could be anybody and anything. If you think something has quality, then what you want to do is rehearse it and break that cycle. Do not replay the past the way it was. Decide what you need, replay it the way you would have liked, and then anytime you think of the future, pre-play it the way you want to do it.
A lot of elite athletes do this. You know, I'm thinking of Tiger Woods, but I think a lot of Steph Curry, maybe, they will play that same play over and over, the winning play, mm-hmm. over and over mm-hmm. and over in their minds until it's muscle memory. They might not have done it in real life, although a lot of them do, but it really becomes a mental muscle memory.
Exactly. Yes, it is. Because associations are created by repetition. So if you're replaying it the way you'd like and you're pre-playing it the way you like, you change your reactions to anybody and anything.
Exactly. You know what I do when I get on my podcast? I've been doing this for 12 years and people will say, well, do you still get nervous? You betcha. I mean, I'm talking with somebody that I've only had a pre-interview with. I've read their books and I feel like, you know, we're a good fit conversationally. But yes, I get nervous. So I do my Wonder Woman pose just before I jump on the phone with you. I stand up, I put my hands on my hips and I am Wonder Woman. It works.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely.
Why not? Rick, it has been fascinating chatting with you today, and I love your books, and I really strongly suggest that people get a hold of these, particularly dealing with meetings you can't stand. I mean, you need both of them, but if I had to pick one mm-hmm. right now, because we are in the Zoom era, I would get that one. So where can people find you before I let you go?
Well, they could find me at rickbrinkman.com, as on the web, or drrickbrinkman.com, drrickbrinkman.com. And, you know, plenty of resources. I've been books, you know, some of us are more listeners, which I am, and there's audios that you can download, a full day seminars. And the books are certainly on Audible, all of them, so you could access them there. I have an online class called Difficult People University, which is 5 hours of video training. A lot of my characters, there's Professor Bologorodko. He's a disembodied floating head, and he has his grad assistants, righty and lefty. And there's Professor McFly, who reminds you to be a fly on the wall and pay attention to communication. So there's a lot of entertaining skits in there. So whatever learning style you have, there's resources there for you.
Thank you. I'm going to have to head on over there. I had no idea that you are such a great mimic. I don't know if you're mimicking anybody else or you're just a cartoonist at heart, but you are fabulous.
Yeah, I was an only child, so I would be entertaining myself. And when I remember the first tape recorder I got, when I got a mic in my hand, suddenly I just was letting it rip. A mic or a camera. I mean, I'm totally an introvert, but in front of a group or a mic or a camera.
Me too.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people say, how can you be an introvert? You're not shy. They're not the same thing. Not at all the same thing. I saw a meme the other day. In fact, I think I posted it on my Facebook page. But basically, introverts are, we don't hate people. We don't dislike people. But we have to be around people that make us extroverts, and that's rare.
Yeah.
You know, we're extroverted around the people that we love and admire. Otherwise, we're
that's
just
true.
Very quiet. You know, I'm actually a very quiet person, believe it or not. In fact, when I got on, you know, I had 10 minutes to go before it was time to start this, and I went, Denise, say something. I hadn't spoken out loud other than to tell the cat, stop yelling at me. That was it. You know, your breakfast is always at 7 o'clock. Stop yelling. Other than that, I hadn't actually spoken out loud, and I realized that I was going to sound rusty and, you know, gravelly, which I do. And I had to, you know, have a little chat with myself before I got on the call with you, so I wouldn't sound terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Strange, I know. Well, listen,
yeah,
thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, pandemic thing. My daughter said to me, "Well, I'm not worried about you because I know you're so well practiced in social distancing already."
Nothing wrong with social distancing at all. Well, listen, before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcast. Just look for your partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Rick, thank you. It was lovely chatting with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.